What are you going to be known to start our meetings? I apologize. Thursday is a Friday, and most of the members, Parliament is on recess as from today. But as you know, some of our members live in provinces like Limpopo, so they have to travel early in order to catch their connecting flights. I'm informed that also the most of the opposition have committed themselves to other engagements. I'm sure FFC would not take that as lack of interest in the work that you're doing. We know that the work that you're doing is very important for our budget of the following year, and it's very important for this committee to engage with the work that you're doing and perhaps those departments that are directly affected in the provinces. And really, Dr. Stey, maybe in your input you will indicate to us, it's clear that with a few members that are here, we will continue, but we would request that we invite you again very early in August, so that you can engage with the broader committee, because to us, it's important that we get an engagement together, and perhaps be able to invite provinces as well, because what I know that what you're going to say does impact on the work of the provinces. Having said that, without any much ado, maybe I should allow you, chairperson of the commission, to address us. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chairman. We really do understand even the fact that the meetings were on and then off, on and off, because we do understand that with the parliament just having opened and with a lot of committees still being formed, it's only natural that those things should happen. And your office has been very good because it has kept us informed virtually on a daily basis about what was happening. I'm here with my colleagues. Across, I have Bongani Kuma. My colleagues are, okay, first I'll start with commissioners, right, because we have four commissioners. Yeah, four, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, we are very carefully selected. Right. Now, we have Bongani Kumar, who is the deputy chair, and next to him is David Savage, who is a commissioner and is situated here. And out of convention, I should have started with a lady, is Tanya Ajam, who is also in Cape Town. So we have two commissioners who can be on call at any time. Yeah, who are here, but they are part time. But between myself and Bongani, we are full time, you know. Right, so can deal with the daily running of what happens in the commission and our interaction with the stakeholders and so forth. Right, yeah. We have a bit of a slide. It's up there. I think for most members, I think members will be aware that, what our mandate is. It's that in slide one. But bullet three, I think, is very important because it highlights the criteria that we must use in making our recommendations. But before I go on, I should indicate then that the commission has about 9 members, 5 national, 2 provincial, and 2 local government. And we're in the process, of course, of inducting four, because the others, their terms ended June 30th. And I think in our next encounter with the chair, we will just give you a list of who they are and so forth, right? I would also like to indicate that our recommendations come as a result of interactions with a lot of stakeholders in the IGFR system. We are observers at the Budget Council, the Budget Forum, and we appear before the provincial legislatures, we appear before Parliament here, and comments and issues that enhance our work, we also pick them up in this recommendation. And as the Chair has already said, our recommendations are an integral part of the budget for the next fiscal year. I would also like to highlight the fact that we have, in some recent past, reviewed the formula. And in line with that, I would like to say that the Commission has identified a number of challenges for the next 5 years, among which is resolving the matter of powers and functions across the three spheres of government, fiscal capacity of provinces and municipalities, and impact of transfers on the delivery outcomes of the government programs. So our submission then addresses in that sense a number of issues. Oh, sorry. Let me just highlight what those issues are. And these issues our different members will speak to. We have reviewed the provincial equitable share formula. We'll talk on the public infrastructure investment. We'll talk on efficiency and equity effects of social grants. We'll talk on the performance of public hospitals, rental housing, management and financing of roads infrastructure, assessment of universal access to water and sanitation services, and assessment of the institutional and fiscal capacity support mechanisms of local government. Now, in reviewing the formula, this was a follow-up of the 2004 review, and out of that review came two very basic recommendations that are principal in nature. The first recommendation was on the design of the IGFR, and the second is a very technical recommendation. Now, on the design of the IGFR, we observe that the expenditure assignments between provinces and national government need to be clarified. Actually, the most challenging part in our work has to do with the funding of concurrent functions. And I think we'll elaborate on that when my colleagues come to make an input on that. And also, the second part in our review of the formula is the alignment of components to national objectives. And I think that also we'll be talking to as we move on. But basically, really, what we are saying is that the formula should remain as it stands, but some tinkering should happen. And part of that tinkering is, number one, the components. Part of the tinkering is that it should be pushed towards an equalization grant. But we're also then saying that inside, technically, the formula, the components of it, need to be aligned to national objectives by province. And then after that, there will be, of course, shortfalls. And those shortfalls should be made good through an equalization grant. But I think we'll elaborate more on that when questions and are raised. Now, that is sort of the highlight in the beginning. And I think now I'll ask my colleague Tanya to come in, and she may actually be more detailed than I have been, if she so feels that she. Yeah, thanks, Tanya.
Good morning, Chief. What I'll be talking about today is public infrastructure and social grants. I think that what's important about the FFC's recommendations is that it's also built on a lot of rigorous research, that we have done models to really assess the impact of our recommendations. So there's a lot of technical work underpinning our recommendations. And in fact, for each chapter in the recommendations document, there's a separate technical document that we released that speaks a bit more about the kind of technical econometric research that underpins this. So on the public infrastructure, I think that it's basically common cause and commonly recognized that we are in a recession, and that government needs to take steps to deal with the high levels of unemployment and poverty, and that one method of doing that is through expanding public infrastructure. Now, what we've done is we've run various econometric simulations to say, well, if we do this, what are the impacts on the economy? And overwhelmingly, the impacts do appear to be beneficial in terms of stimulating growth, consumption, and investment, and also have a positive impact on household welfare, although how that impact manifests itself will differ from region to region. What our concern is that we cannot only spend on building infrastructure. We need to make sure that that infrastructure actually remains a legacy and continues to deliver service over its useful life. And this has been one area where we have been less good at. We have created schools, created hospitals, but at the end of the day, those schools and hospitals are falling apart because of lack of maintenance, and then we're injecting yet still more money in to create new ones. And the problem is that unless we have a structured way of thinking about maintenance for the whole country, we're not going to get the full benefit of our potential infrastructure spending. So some of our recommendations are that there be an increase both in departmental baselines and the quantum of appropriate investment in public infrastructure linked to basic services. So what you'll be doing is you'll be stimulating the economy through constructing the infrastructure, but you're also increasing the capability of the public service to extend access and quality, hopefully, of basic services. Where there are already allocations in the system for infrastructure, we are recommending that there should be measures to improve the quality of targeted outcomes on infrastructure investment. So in other words, there might be plans, there might even be budget allocations, but is it being implemented so that we achieve the original objectives that we were hoping to achieve? On the maintenance side, we are recommending that government adopt a comprehensive infrastructure maintenance strategy specific to sectors with high impact on unemployment and poverty. So what we're saying is that just as construction of infrastructure can be labor intensive and stimulate the economy, and maintenance can also play that role. It can actually create jobs as well as extending the service potential of government service delivery assets like hospitals, clinics, schools, etc. Very importantly, much of the conditional grant system tends to focus on capital expenditure because of the intergovernmental nature of how these infrastructure services are delivered. But it's also important that the intergovernmental cooperation in regard to maintenance planning be strengthened, especially at local and provincial spheres of government. So it's not like we have a conditional grant that will build a capital asset. We should also see 4 or 5 years down the line what are the provisions for maintenance expenditure on those assets so that the assets achieve their full service potential and have the longest possible useful life. So those are basically the headline recommendations on public infrastructure. What I'll move on to now is the social grants arena. Like the public infrastructure section, there is a separate paper on this, you know, where you can find the facts and the figures and the analysis upon which our recommendations are based. But basically, our headline starts with the recognition that there are significant levels of poverty and unemployment in this country. With the recession, that is increasing daily and will probably increase in the near term. So there's got to be some sort of social safety net, some sort of social response. If you look at the performance of the social grant system to date, all empirical evidence indicates that our social grant system has indeed been well targeted. It is reaching the lowest 40% of the households, the poorest of the households. And through this grant system, there has been a reduction in both individual and household poverty. But that speaks to where the system has got so far. And the question is, how do we move forward, right? Will those benefits still hold, or will we be creating costs that will maybe compromise some of those benefits? So there are certain concerns attached to the social grants as well, and so we need to weigh up these potential social costs against the social benefits of further expansion. So there is a concern that access to, for example, child support grants, etc., could discourage labor market participation by economic active dependents. So the idea is that, you know, instead of seeing some of these grants as temporary measures and trying to enter the labor market, you might have increased dependency. At present, this doesn't seem to be an overwhelming factor. The type of research by Sefas van der Berg at Stellenbosch University hasn't really flagged that as a major problem, but it is something that we need to consider. There's also the concern that grants might tie work seekers to rural areas where opportunities are scant. There's also concern that you might be creating dependency through the grant system. And so instead of it being a temporary measure that lifts households out of poverty, other measures, like, for example, the education system, are not providing ladders to lift people out of poverty. So you provide a band-aid, but you're not providing a long-term path to get households out of poverty. There are also concerns that some grant recipients, for example, HIV/AIDS sufferers, might not seek treatment so that they can continue with the grant rather than seeking treatment if it means that the grant entitlement might be threatened by that. There are also concerns about, for example, the child support grant. What is the impact on teenage fertility? Could you be creating perverse incentives there as well? So I think that, to summarize, the empirical evidence have shown that the grant system has been well targeted, that the benefits far outweigh the costs, but there are potential incentive effects that could emerge should government choose to expand the system further. Our recommendations maintain that government should increase the rollout of social grants to cushion the vulnerable people from the effects of the economic downturn. However, it must be done in a sustainable way. When we actually gave our recommendations, we did it on a different information set. So, you know, we actually haven't seen revised forecasts coming through Treasury, etc. So the points that we make then are even more relevant now, given that we're seeing the effect of the global economic downturn on our fiscal framework and on our spending. It's very important that government manages the risks and opportunities associated with the scaling up of social grants. So, for instance, you know, are we going to try and increase grant amounts for existing beneficiaries, or are we going to say, well, let's keep the grant amounts the same, but try and expand the coverage of the particular beneficiaries? We also have to understand what are the net incentive effects across all different grants. So not trying to treat each of these grants separately, but saying how do they collectively impact on households. And we also need to be concerned and monitor if social grants are crowding out other forms of social expenditure, such as health, such as education. Now, in countries all over the world, if your service delivery doesn't work, like you're not producing good health services, or you're not producing good education services. The easiest thing is to actually pay a grant, because in a grant, your input is your output, right? But what does this mean for providing an overall package of social services? So it's nice paying grants, but your education system is not resulting in real benefits that can make sure that this intergenerational income mobility and progress forward across households. We also recommend that social assistance should be managed in such a way as to eventually reduce dependency on social grants, and that government should use infrastructure expansion to provide opportunity for workfare programs, as well as activities identified in the expanded public works program. And the government should consider the EPWP to pilot workfare immediately. So what we're saying when we look at workfare is we're looking at conditional cash transfers. You're saying there is going to be a grant component, but there's also a work component. So you can actually have some sort of skills transfer, and you can bring people who are not into the economy formally into the economy. So I think that basically sums up those two sections, and I'll hand over back to the Chief.
Thanks, Chair. Now, Deborah is our researcher, technical person, and we have asked him to talk on three categories of our presentation: public hospitals, rental housing, and financing of road infrastructure.
Thanks, and greetings. Now, for the next three chapters on public hospitals, road infrastructure, and rental housing, there are three thematic issues that are emanating from these chapters. One is the role of institutions, fiscal reforms, as well as the role played by norms and standards. So on public hospitals, the Commission is making observations that legislation is there. You know, Constitution does state that access to health is a right. There's been some legislative developments to this regard. But in practice, the implementation seems to be a problem. You know, there's a lack of coordination around administration departments as well as the service sites. Service sites in this regard is public hospital. And, I mean, also this links to the recommendation that we have made in the PS that, you know, the issues of functions, where do we locate the functions, you know, to make decisions. And our observation is that, you know, the location of functions does affect the performance of public hospitals. And also, in terms of the budgeting, there are no standardized formats to budget for hospitals, also based on the level of service that different hospitals are offering. So it is difficult in terms of oversight to have a clear picture as to how hospitals are being budgeted for. In this regard, then the Commission is making recommendation that there must be a legislative provisions for norms and standards for the functioning of public hospitals, because certain programs within the public hospitals needs to be informed by norms and standards. So in the absence of norms and standards, it is difficult then to budget adequate or to measure the adequacy of funding for different types of hospitals and the levels of service. And we also recommend that budget formats be standardized. I think this will assist not only us, but as well as Parliament in terms of benchmarking different hospitals. So it will be easier if budget formats are standardized. So that is a chapter on public hospitals. The chapter on rental housing is part of our overall program on the delivery of housing by government in South Africa. And we also make an observation that there must be a balance between ownership and rental, because, you know, areas of economic opportunities in South Africa are located in urban areas, and in certain instances people don't want to own houses but want to go to urban areas and rent. And we are saying that there is an imbalance in South Africa with regards to that, and as a result a housing backlog is increasing. And here is a graph just showing that people that are earning below 2,500 per month are the ones that are looking for housing, and some of them are willing to rent, but the gap is emerging. So if you look at from 2002 to 2006, this area shows that houses, flats, and rooms in the backyard has been increasing the demand. So people rather staying in flats or other areas of rental opportunities, they opt to rent houses or rooms in townships and urban areas. And that has been increasing. And there are other factors that are hampering the delivery of housing. As I said, that this linked to the issues of institution, the lack of coordinated approach, there are cumbersome requirements for social housing institutions to qualify for grants, you know, in order to for them to deliver this social or rental housing. And also the issue of income bands, that, you know, if you use that, some of the income bands are not necessarily linked to the cost of living. So as they are reviewed, some don't keep pace with the trends in inflation, and that leads to errors of inclusion and exclusion in certain instances. And we make recommendations that then the criteria for accessing social housing capital restructuring grant need to be reviewed, so that projects that fall outside the restructuring zones, the structuring zones being the areas that are designated for social housing, that we need to review that policy, so that we expand the quantum of funding. And also the last point that relates to the issue of norms and standards, you know, because currently we don't have a criteria that is fixed to say, do we allow or do we provide housing based on a particular square meter? And we are saying that we need to have a range in that regard. There is, around the issues of institutions, we are saying that the Social Housing Regulatory Authority should play a role in coordinating other departments responsible for human settlement, because the frustration by social housing institutions is that they build these units, but some of them are not connected to other services like water, your roads, and so forth. So we are saying that the regulatory authority should play that particular role. And the issue of income bands also, we are saying that it should be linked to inflation trends. The chapter on roads infrastructure, that's also linked to roads themselves. We are saying that roads are very important for economic development, for ferrying people and goods and services. Infrastructure maintenance is also important. And our observation is that some of our national and provincial roads are deteriorating, more especially provincial roads, because investment does not keep or is not keeping up with the requirements for maintenance or expansion. And this is against the international benchmark that says that only about 10% of the national road network should be in poor or very poor condition. And in South Africa, our research shows that, and other studies as well, that about 60% is in a poor and very poor condition, and this is deteriorating further. And we make recommendations that, and this is linked to our chapter on infrastructure investment, that there must be an increase in roads investment. And we also need to review the way we fund provincial and local government roads. And if you look at this chapter, in line with the recommendations we are making on PES, provincial equitable share, we are saying that amongst the options to fund roads is that we need to review the PES and also think about how to fund roads, you know. And here we are saying that we need to look at that, but not only the state funding roads, but there's a role of developmental institutions to fund roads. And the other option is that if the road is economical, let us also consider putting tolls in that road, but do a feasibility study to make sure that, you know, your benefits always outpace your costs. Those are the options that we are putting on roads. And from an institution point of view, is that we are saying that there must be a role played by Department of Transport in coordinating the these road authorities in terms of roads development and investment in the country, because, you know, some of the roads they intersect and others are in feeders. So we can't necessarily locate roads within, you know, your spheres of government, but there must be this intergovernmental coordination in terms of road development. And lastly, address technical skills, which also inhibits the delivery of roads. Yeah, thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Joe. David, why don't I talk on water and local government institutions, right?
Yes, and yeah, these are the two final sections of the presentation and of our recommendations, and again supported by fairly detailed technical work that's available as well. So I will just touch on some of the main issues. I think water and sanitation is an issue that is critical both to increasingly seen as critical both to economic growth and its potential to be a bottleneck to growth, and to poverty alleviation, which has long been recognized in our policy frameworks. Overall, I think the Commission's review found that there's an emerging gap between some very noble policy intentions in the sector and the implementation of those intentions. There's some very significant challenges facing the sector, particularly in terms of a lack of qualified staff and insufficient investment in infrastructure and the maintenance of infrastructure, and this is where there's a potential bottleneck to economic growth that has been talked about, I think, even in the public domain recently, but also important social impacts in terms of poor households in particular losing access to basic services that they've obtained since 1994. There are significant affordability issues that face poor households, and there is, in terms of the institutional framework for the management of water services, as yet no coherent framework of oversight for how water services authorities manage trade-offs in the design and the determination of their water tariffs, so that they're able to balance the need for investment in infrastructure and maintenance and preserving access, particularly by poor households, to basic services. I'll quickly just run through some of those points in a little bit more detail. When it comes to the policy intentions and actual performance, I think this is probably most strikingly demonstrated by looking at progress in reaching targets that have been set by government. The initial target for universal access to water and sanitation services, to water that everyone would have access, all South Africans would have access to safe drinking water by 2008. In 2007, the community survey indicated that only 88.6% of households had access to pipe water, and not all households would have access to safe water by the target date. In sanitation, there's been a target that was set for 2010, which is next year, and the community survey indicates that in 2007, a little more than 60% of households have access to service, and it's very unlikely that by 2010 that target would be achieved. And there's now been a revision of targets, and I think that that's an important to 2014, and that's a very important policy shift that has happened in the sector, for which there's been remarkably little public debate, considering the criticality, I think, for poor households in particular, of obtaining access to basic water services and basic safe hygienic sanitation services. The Commission on the question of basic water and sanitation recommends that the free basic water and sanitation subsidy policy may require a review to ensure that the shortcomings that are implicit in the current system of free basic water and sanitation don't outweigh the benefits. There's a discussion in the technical documentation around some of the risks of rising block tariffs, which are seen as the key strategy by the water sector to fund free basic services. The limitations in terms of the leakage, the errors of exclusion and inclusion that they introduce into the subsidy system, and potential medium to longer term incentives for inefficiency by the service providers through providing a supply side subsidy that makes you lose sight of the real cost of water services provision. And finally, the principles and practices guiding the tariff and subsidy structures and price levels in the water sector need to be made clear, and perhaps more importantly, routinely monitored, because if one gets price levels wrong, as we've discovered in the electricity sector, one can generate long-term problems that are very difficult to work one way out of in the short term. So if we are not charging appropriately for water, including our subsidy strategies, it may lead to the shortfalls in the expansion of infrastructure to accommodate rising demand, both at the bulk level in terms of dams and so forth, but also in terms of the distribution level in terms of pipe networks and so forth. So a much more robust routine monitoring of the appropriateness of price levels and a clear balance between the need to fund the maintenance of the network with the need to ensure universal access needs to be achieved. On sanitation services, the Commission's review really demonstrated that sanitation services in South Africa so far have rather been treated as an infrastructure issue, where sanitation is around, I think as the policy says, it's around human dignity, public and personal health. It's not around infrastructure per se. In fact, just providing infrastructure doesn't necessarily ensure that people are going to receive those outcomes of that those developmental outcomes that we're looking for of dignity and health. Therefore, we really need to, as the policy says, but we actually need to take this into practice, is to reconfigure our sanitation strategies around behavioral change, around eliminating open defecation, which is a significant problem and remains a significant problem in South Africa when people do not have access to either sanitation facilities or clean, healthy sanitation facilities, overflowing VIP toilets and so forth, or unmaintained flush toilets. So that the focus should not purely be on the provision of infrastructure, but also on behavior change by households, and that is in line with an emerging global best practice on how to make sure that sanitation outcomes are achieved. Government also needs to explore appropriate sanitation technologies more robustly. I think that at the investment end, there's been a significant preference, de facto preference, for waterborne networked sanitation systems, which are extremely expensive to install, but also extremely expensive to operate and maintain. And that may ultimately limit rail access to sanitation facilities by households and the achievement of the sanitation outcomes of dignity and health that are so critical in the sector. The Commission overall recommends that that at the institutional level there be much firmer separation between policy making in the sector, the establishment of targets, and the regulatory functions in the sector, which is the monitoring of prices to make sure that appropriate trade-offs and monitoring the achievement of targets to make sure that the appropriate trade-offs are made. And so the Commission actually recommends the establishment of a national water regulator that will, I think, both help government at national level to be held to account, so not allowing targets to sag from 2008 to 2014 without any explanation, but also hold water services authorities at the local level to account in terms of their performance. That can issue licenses, it can regulate tariffs, it can monitor planning and infrastructure investments, and regulate compliance relative to key norms and standards in the sector. At the moment, these functions are performed by the National Department of Water Affairs, and Environment, which both sets policy, supports Water Services Authority, and plays the role of the regulator. The result of that is very little regulation happens, because to actually have to enforce compliance is to implicitly admit on behalf of the department that it has either set policy inappropriately or failed to offer appropriate support. So there's a conflict of interest there. It's also recommended that the regulator could play a role in regulating public-private partnerships in the sector and promoting alternative service delivery models. Now, by public-private partnerships, you're not just meaning large-scale privatization, however unlikely that may seem in the current context. We're talking also about partnerships with community structures, and I think one thing we've seen since 2000 onwards is actually a decline in the use of small-scale community-based mechanisms of service delivery, particularly in rural areas that were so effectively piloted post-1994. A falling back on a reliance on very state-centric models of water services delivery that have municipalities at fairly large scale providing services for small-scale networks in rural areas, where communities are often much better placed to manage and operate those networks. And I think we thought the regulator can play a very important role in monitoring macro trends, macro demand and supply trends in the water supply industry as well. That function not really being independently undertaken. DWAF does have some historically strong technical capacity in this regard, but that probably needs to move into the public domain through the formal regulatory system a little more. I'm brushing over some very large issues there, but I'll leave that for perhaps discussion, or we can reading the technical reports. When it comes to the vexed question of institutional and fiscal capacity support mechanisms for local government, this has been something that I think since 1994 government has really spent a lot of time and money on, yet we commonly hear that municipalities lack capacity. And so the Commission really looked at this issue on the basis that there's a very significant amount of public resources both generated locally and from national government that go to local governments, and if there's no capacity to spend there, these capacity support programs become very critical in leveraging better spending outcomes across all of the public resources that are available at the municipal level. So they may actually be the linchpin, the intergovernmental relationship and spending outcomes. Now, I think it's very important to note that not all local governments are in dire crisis. Yes, some are struggling, but many have shown exceptional progress in delivery of services. And when one looks at the data across a range of data sources, one sees that comparing the 2001 census with a 2007 community survey. On a municipal level, one can see progress that has been made. But municipalities do face capacity challenges and sometimes unable to perform their functions. And this has led national government to introduce capacity building programs and a number of grant programs to support capacity building. The Commission has reviewed these programs, and I think it's a fairly disturbing picture that emerges. There are a very large number of capacity building programs, and they are typically not aligned to the objectives of the sector, the priority objectives in local government, or the priority problems that are facing local government. They are often uncoordinated, they're repetitive, they're reactive. It is not there's one case, I think it's Sekakuni District Municipality, where they've had capacity building on financial management from several different sources, all of which have dealt with specifically revenue issues, none of which have coordinated with each other. Now, that is an extreme abuse of limited resources in capacity building, and that are available for capacity building. This hasn't been, the capacity building initiatives are typically also not sequenced, they're not independently monitored, and nor have any of them been subject to any rigorous independent evaluation of their performance. And in fact, the Commission finds that the net outcome of the system is perhaps the creation of negative incentives to actually reduce capacity in municipalities, because if you fail at something, you are going to get flooded with support. Yet if you succeed, the support will vaporize and go away. So you want to make sure that you don't succeed too much. You want to make sure that you don't fall outside of the ambit of these capacity building programs, because you get a lot of free advice, money, and so forth. Your incentive is to stay in the program, not to try and work your way out of the program. The more you fail, the more support you will get. And one needs to, I think, remain aware of those. Exactly. In economic terms, what's called a perverse incentive. There's a broader discussion, but in the technical documentation, but the recommendation is that local governments themselves need to be central to setting the agenda for capacity building programs. One can't just arrive and say, I want to build your capacity. That encourages a culture of saying, well, you decide, you know best, I'll sit back and make sure the system keeps failing enough so that you stay here to keep doing what you do. Prior to capacity building programs being implemented and developed, one needs to have a comprehensive assessment of the problem and a design process, both at national level and at local level, so not just emergency responses to particular perceived problems facing the sphere. Capacity programs need to be aligned to each stage of the transition of municipalities. Not all municipalities are facing the same circumstances. Yet we find a highly capable municipality like the city of Johannesburg benefiting from programs that are really designed for very, very capacity-constrained, small, largely rural municipalities. And absorbing resources they really should have. They have no business in absorbing. And the comprehensive programs, the capacity programs really do need to be comprehensive. They can't just focus on personnel training or the deployment of an advisor. One's really got to look at the root causes of a failure to perform functions, whether that be policy failures, things that the national government or provincial government has got wrong, that is always putting too much pressure on the municipal system, to systems that are engaged at or underway at the municipal level, to, yes, in certain cases, the deployment of advisors and so forth. There's been a marked swing in capacity building programs to the deployment of advisors to municipalities. I think there are about 800 advisors, perhaps more now, that are deployed to municipalities across the country. There's more than two per municipality. And that may not really be solving the problems if those problems are located in systems. either intergovernmental systems or poor implementation of systems at the municipal level. The Commission recommends there needs also to be a very clear understanding of what constitutes a lack of capacity. I think often a lack of capacity is just the catch-all phrase for anything that might be going wrong in a municipality. That tends to explain away everything. Sometimes it's just a performance failure. Someone's not doing their job, they're not pitching up for work. That's not a lack of capacity. It's not a lack of capacity to enforce basic human resources protocols, but it's not a lack of capacity. I meet many, and I think one of the commissioners and our staff meet very many highly intelligent and capable municipal senior managers right across the country in the most surprising municipalities. And so it's not that there's no capacity at all. So we need to be very clear what we consider to be a lack of capacity and how that might vary across different municipal contexts. There also needs to be a clear separation of the responsibilities in capacity building programs for setting up the program, in fact operating as a service authority and as a service provider. In many instances we see national government departments running capacity building programs where they both establish the program and run it, and when they come to evaluate and monitor it, they have an incentive to show how successful they're being. The role of not being able to hold anyone to account for how effectively programs are performing in delivering improved municipal capabilities. They're really more interested in just showing how good they are at doing what they're doing. And the replication of poorly defined roles and responsibilities between national government, provincial government, and district municipalities with respect to local municipality capacity building programs also is an area that requires additional thought. Some very basic recommendations, and it's surprising, I think, that at this stage, you know, in 2009, the Commission needs to be making these points. So capacity building programs really do need to have measurable objectives, clear timelines, clear targets for what they're intending to achieve, and that's really not the case with many of the programs as they stand now. The Commission does recommend that a variety of grant instruments continue to be used for capacity building because it thinks that the needs are very different across different sectors in the municipal sphere and across different municipalities. But there is a need for alignment between these programs. Seven programs all trying to address municipal revenue improvement. Sounds like we don't really know how to address municipal revenue improvement. And on the flagship program of government on capacity building, which is the CIENSA mandate program implemented through the DBSA, the Commission recommends that a much more transparent approach to the management of this program be adopted, considering the very significant amounts of resources that are being put into it. And as a start, recommends that it be subject to the provisions of the Division of Revenue Act, so that Parliament and other stakeholders are able to see exactly how resources are being distributed by this program. There's some anecdotal evidence that municipalities with no capacity problems are benefiting significantly from the program, and that in some instances the Development Bank may be using the resources as a sweetener for municipalities to take loans from the bank. I've come across instances in even metropolitan municipalities where they've specifically asked, if I'm going to take a loan from you for infrastructure investment, as opposed to a loan from another bank or wherever, I want to know that I'm going to get CIENSA Mandate support, which seems like there may be a conflict of interest in the DBSA's role there, and that we may need to look, we certainly may need to start with getting greater transparency over the distribution of resources in CIENSA Mandate, and the way to do that would be through the Division of Revenue Act allocation process. Thank you.
Commissioner, if you have a comment on anything, or you come in during question and answers.
Yeah, I think I'll come in during any of the questions. Yeah.
Thanks very much. Chair, I think we've done our presentation. Thank you very much. Comprehensive presentation. And the question of time really becomes such a factor, because I think that we would really need to have more time with you so that we can also have access to some of the documents that you keep on referring to, the research documents that you keep on referring to. And especially that many of our members are new and so are not very familiar with what FSC is doing, but I think that perhaps we'll have to find a way of engaging more so that we can also be able to have a clearer understanding and be able to engage with the department as well when they come up with their own strategic plans, which would relate to, I suppose, perhaps would relate to the recommendations that we have made to government. Colleagues, that is the presentation. I don't know if you want to comment or to raise questions. Comrade Maka.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. As you have...
Sorry, Comrade, just to say to FSC, Honorable Maka is the whip of the committee. So the other person was waiting us. If there's things, anything go wrong, don't come to me, go to him.
thank you, Comrade Chair. I think we've already covered some of us. Do we are new here. It means even the acronyms here are wreaking havoc with us. Maybe some of the questions might will be very clear that this person doesn't understand some of these things. The first question will be a general question on, I see there are recommendations here. Where do you take the recommendations to? Is it the finance department, or is it with the reconfiguration now of departments? Where are you going to take your recommendations, either to finance or economic development or to the monitoring and what the planning in the president's office? At least a clarification on that one. So that's correct. Some will just be to clarify myself. The first will be an equalization grant. What does that entail? What are we equalizing there? And how does it work? Yes, as you will see, most of the questions are just clarifications. Yeah, and on page 12, the presenter said, usually in some countries, if a system fails, whether it's health or education, the best way that they do is to introduce a grant. I try to think very hard over it. How does that work? I mean, if a health system fails and you give this sick person a grant, how does it help? That is my thinking. If I can understand maybe in education, if it fails, maybe lack of skills, you might give them a grant, but in health, If you could clarify that for me. That's correct. And then on page 80, you talk about the slow disinvestment of funds to social housing institutions. Who is the culprit here? Why is the situation like that? And if maybe there is a suggested solution, I'm not sure whether it is in the recommendations. And on page 19, we talk about designated restructuring zones. If that could be clarified to me, what those things are. And if I was to comment, especially on the presentation, it is for us who are new. It is a bit on a higher level. It's not basic. Not that we are lazy to read for ourselves. We will do that after this first presentation, because if we try to do that before a presentation, it might not have made sense. Page 20, the qualifying income bands should be reviewed. If this could be unpacked, whether we are talking about for the grants by government, including, or maybe are we talking about the banks, or are we talking about both? Just where are these income bands applying, and what are you actually referring to? And then on page 24, the very last bullet point, there's no current framework of oversight for how water service authorities manage trade-offs. What trade-offs are we talking about here? And then on page 27, as I said, you will bear with me that if we are new in here, some of these things tend to be difficult for us. The whole of page 27. If you simply say shortcomings implicit in the current subsidy system do not outweigh benefits, that is what you need to ensure. I don't even know what the shortcomings are. So, principles and practice guiding both tariff and subsidy structures and plus are made clear and routinely monitored. I don't have an idea of what you are talking about. I don't know the shortcomings and the subsidy structure and so on. That is exactly what I said, or it's a bit difficult, it's at one notch higher for a new person, the presentation, for a new person to grapple with it. And lastly, the Commission recommends that there be a separation of policy from regulatory functions in the water service sector. What is the case now? What are we having? And did I say lastly? lastly. Okay, the graphs. If you could take us through the graphs. I checked the colors there. You didn't indicate which color represents what. So it means, according to me, the graphs didn't help me in any way. Because there's orange, there's yellow, there's
purple.
Yeah, so if you didn't indicate or what is this for, then it means the graph is as good as useless for a layman like myself. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm going to the social grants and the type of recipients. I wonder how far you have gone with the issue of the problem that the real biological mothers, this is a child care grant, are actually misusing the money. Is there an opportunity or a chance of that money being incorporated into the real caregivers of these children, if we've gone through that one? And I wish we had time to know about this funder back. Is it the professor or... I wish we had some document because it was just short, but it seems it has a lot of valuable information. You just mentioned it in passing. And then the issue of linking social grants to employment, has it anything to do with this new expanded public works program of incentives, or is it one thing? Something, I'm going to housing now. There's something called DSA. I forgot what it stands for in full. But what I know is that it's an act that fast tracks a transfer of agricultural land into housing so that the disadvantaged can acquire houses. I don't. But in reality, doesn't work like that, because we find that this agricultural land actually has a big loophole, because that tribunals used where the land is transferred to developers to build holiday farms. It happens in the area where I have a constituency. They say they used, I don't know what Facilitation Act. I wonder whether you've gone through it and what your comments are, so that you should also, because it has to do with service delivery to the poorest of the poor, and if there's a loophole there, it doesn't achieve the intention of it. Original intention, this act. I just wonder if Teboho can say something about it, if he's aware of it. The infrastructure, I don't know. And when it comes to the dams, there are many dams. What is the problem in these dams going directly to people, servicing people? We know we have this, the Whoop Dam, which has been going on for a long time, and there are other dams that are just next to the people, but the people run short of water. So what input do you have, and what advice can you give us, so that when we meet water people, water affairs, we engage constructively in issues like that? And there are these NGOs. How effective are they? And I know of one that talks about harvesting water. What relationship do they actually have with water as a, that can assist our people so that water can be harvested. It doesn't get wasted when it rains. Do they? I think I'll start. I'll temporarily stop there because I think this water harvesting and NGOs can have positive impact if thoroughly and involved in if they become partners with Water Affairs. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Comrade, Comrade Mother.
Thank you, Chairperson. David, you gave us something to laugh about and think about. If people have got lack of capacity to go to work, that's a good one. But can you give me the relationship or where do these come to work together, if at all? The water regulator and the water commission, do they ever work together in any way?
Sorry, which water commission?
Commission on Water or Water Commission, but there is...
Water Research Commission.
Water Research Commission, yes. Yeah, you deprived us of the language of the graph. I had the same problem that graphs can talk very loud, but you just made them all deaf. In what way does the indigent policy on water and maybe electricity help the poor? Does it really help the poor? Can you just talk on that one? I think I agree with you. Departments have got an addiction for use of consultants. What do you say to that? How best can we get rid of consultants and use people that will benefit the departments? Because consultants get there, they take millions, they go away, the department or whatever area remains as was before. Apart from advisors, what else can we use rather than consultants coming in to milk the department? As we speak, we are forever having problems with seepage of various things into the water, including fecal material. We've had this thing in the past year at places like Delmas and other places. What's the role of the municipality there, or the role of the Department of Water Affairs, or the role of any of the councils like the CSIR in that instance? Tebogo, you spoke about the issue of housing. So I was just wondering that now we're talking of humans, housing and sanitation. Now that we're looking at housing as human settlement, are we not beginning to address the various aspects of housing? That a house will come with 1, 2, 3, 4, seeing that we're now looking at human settlement. If that program takes up and off well, we might begin to address some of the issues may be addressed. You also spoke of developmental institutions that can fund the roads. Can you just share with us what those developmental institutions may be? Tanya spoke about social grants. And yes, social grants are good, as good can be. But I think it's important that as people are given social grants, we also keep dependency that you talk about. So how far can we take social grants? To what extent? And then what can we do so that we begin to wean off people from social grants? Because true, once people get social grants, they become perpetual users of social grants. Even those people, they should not be getting social grants. Because I have got a disability, I decide to go and get a disability grant. And I don't deserve it. I don't know what you can say to that one. And, Chairperson, you spoke about the five challenges that FFC has seen or has identified, but you mentioned only three. You deprived us of the other two. Maybe you can share the other two with us. And maybe also if you can share with us the concurrent functions. The reason we're asking these maybe silly questions is because some of us, one, are visitors, two, are here for the first time. Thanks.
These questions are important questions. They're not silly questions.
Oh. Sorry, Chair, before I leave the podium.
Okay.
How do you think, with the scenario now, where do you find us as far as the MDGs are concerned? Are we close to meeting some of the MDGs, or we're still far away from meeting the MDGs of 2014 as we talk today, 2009?
Okay. Thank you very much, colleagues. I think that the questions have been raised. I don't think that we should really feel that questions that we're raising are not supposed to be raised, because my understanding of Parliament's work is that you just learn all the time, and we should not feel anyway compromised by raising these questions. I think they are important, and unless we understand them. But as I said that earlier, I think that FFC, in the past years, we have developed some kind of understanding with them that when we need them to support us in some of the, sometimes in dealing with in departments, departments sometimes would come with certain claims that you can see that this one is a bit ridiculous, and but maybe we're not going to need them very much. We're going to establish a budget office. Your work is being threatened. Yeah. Now, that's my own article, question or comments is the, you know, I agree with someone who said, I think that is two colleagues who commented on the graphs, that sometimes the graphs can say a lot, and there's a need to understand them. The other graph, first one, was on rental housing. We heard that you're saying there is increase in this demand for that category of people. But again, I'm not sure whether, where this increase is reflected in the graph. It's not very clear. But if you could maybe just clarify that. But the when we had some electricity, what was it called? This cut outages. You know, I think that there was a lot of now halabaloo. People were saying, "No, we're going to have a shortage of this. We'll have a shortage of that," and also water was raised as a possible that we might have experienced possible shortages in water in future. I'm not sure that in the studies that have been undertaken, is there a threat of South Africa perhaps in future, not in experiencing any water shortage, perhaps. Is that a realistic? But the department has all the time assured the nation that we don't have. I mean, that would not necessarily be experienced, seeing that some water is being imported from the neighboring countries. The Commissioner Savage spoke about the, I mean, not being able to meet our goals of ensuring that there was access of clean, potable water by the end of 2008. Was it our own targets? Were they based on 2008, by the way, vis-à-vis those of the MDGs, which were based in 2015? I thought that we were based on 2011. I'm not sure. I'm really speaking, yes, subject to correction. You also spoke extensively about this capacity building in the municipalities. I think that I agree with you. I mean, a lot of energy is invested in trying to turn things around for revenue, increasing revenue in the municipalities. But isn't the reason for that perhaps that one of the municipalities' basic, the municipalities are not as financially supported as the other spheres of government, and therefore they have to generate their own, what you call, funds. And clearly, in some instances, we do know that municipalities, including your big, what you call municipalities, for instance, do not collect revenue in the way that they should be, what you call it, doing it. But I'm not saying that that should be done at the expense of everything else or trying to justify that. But there are, I don't know if we have looked at the reasons why are they not, or are we not looking at capacity building for other areas, like ensuring that there is proper management of water, for instance. Do you think that we have enough skills that, if we were having enough skills, those people would have obviously interest in ensuring that we're looking at these matters? But just the last comment on the issue of hospitals. You spoke about standardization of budgets for hospital infrastructure. I'm not very clear what that means. I'm really not clear. I mean, also thinking that the needs are not the same in all provinces and the size of hospitals in all countries. What does this statement mean, exactly, of standardization of I think that that's my comment. But I think that what two colleagues perhaps will do, as Ella indicated, that maybe there will be a need to re-invite FFC, and I'm hoping that by that time, I don't know if Doctor, you have enough copies for this, and or there's enough copies, I'm told. And I think that if members could go through these copies, it would be better than when we meet FFC next time, because there's more information here. FSC has been very generous to us because their offices are at the Constitution House. Mm-hmm. I don't mind if we go there and just go through some of their documents. In fact, what is very helpful with some of the researches here that they are referring to, there are other previous recommendations that have been made in the past. Some of them are coming back again, maybe more strongly than before. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'll quickly do the easy ones. we will send electronic versions of the technical reports. Maybe if you could just make sure that my office gets all the emails, right, then we'll do so. And and then the hard copies when they are ready, we'll do that as well. It's just that the technical reports are being printed at the moment. Yeah, but when they're ready, we'll do so. Right. And, yes, thanks. And then to Member Michael, we say Michael.
Marke.
Oh, I didn't hear well. That's a Marke. Apologies, yeah.
Thank
right.
you.
Yeah, so the acronyms are all in here.
That's right.
Yes, right. Yeah, no, thank you. Oh, okay. No, that's good, right, yeah. And then we know who should answer what, but Bongana, I think now I must catch you on equalization. What you could do is just position it within the intergovernmental and then indicate why we suggested equalization grant.
Okay.
Yeah, right. Maybe we start with you.
Okay.
Yeah, and then after that, Tanya. And then I think, okay, I'll go to David. And then most questions came to you as well. Yeah, okay. Then David and then. Yeah.
All right. Let me first lay the process around the recommendations, who they go to and how they must be dealt with. The recommendations, as the presentation indicates, are submitted in terms of the constitution and legislation. So basically the recommendations are made to the legislature. They also must go to the Minister of Finance. And the processing thereof basically is through, for Parliament, is through these particular kinds of hearings. We would expect that there will be some hearings with the relevant departments that are affected here. And that process takes place like that in the legislature. And then with respect to the executive, the Minister of Finance through the Budget Council also gets inputs from the executive at provincial level, at local government level, through the budget forum. In terms of how we then relate with, given the new structure that has come up, that's an issue that has arisen also at the Budget Council of which we are a member. We do not think that there is a direct implication for us at this point in time, so long as the relationships between the existing departments and the new departments have not been resolved. For the FFC, it's very clear how our process actually operates. So we have relationships with departments that with whom we work through the MINMEX. We will basically continue in that with that kind of a relationship. Where we need something from a department, we normally are allowed through the Financial and Fiscal Commission Act to request whatever information that we want. So we don't think that there's going to be any need for drastic changes in light of the new department and all of that. It's really going to be part and parcel of what comes out of the budget council, how the Minister of Finance relates with the rest of the new department, would probably provide some guidance on how we need to respond to the needs of these other new departments. But we don't think that that's a big issue for the commission. Now, with respect to the issue around the equalization grant, it's really a technical term, I suppose. when one makes a presentation or prepares a presentation like that, we make a lot of assumptions about what people know. But in grant design, when you design conditional grants, when you design conditional grants or non-conditional grants, you're basically looking at an issue where you are filling a gap in between expenditure and revenue needs. Now, when you look at the revenue side, you know, people are assigned certain revenue sources. So you assign certain revenue sources in the form of taxes, user charges, and all of that to a particular sphere of government. On the expenditure side, you assign certain functions. For example, you would assign education, health, water, whatever, to a sphere of government. Now, the revenue sources versus the expenditure assignments do not always match. So what you have is a gap between revenue sources on the one side and your expenditure need, which is the total amount of money that you require to finance certain things. So you introduce a grant basically that tries to cover that gap. Now, it is impossible in the real world for you to be able to get a grant that will cover that gap exactly in the way in which you would. So the ideal is what you would prefer, but we live in a second best world. So in order to equalize, you then, when you're designing an equalization grant, you look at what on average, if I look at across the nine provinces, for example, I look at what on average is the amount of revenue sources assigned to them and what do they raise. We know that this will depend on fiscal capacity, economic activity, and all of that. But on average, they must raise a certain level of revenues. And then probably, let's say, they raise 6% on average. So we expect that of their expenditure need, they will raise 6%. I then go on the expenditure side and say, on average, what is it that they are spending? Right. Then I then look at the differences across now individuals. Who is above the average and who is below the average? Now, equalization requires that those that are below the average are actually pushed up towards the average, and those that are above you let them roll like that. So what it really implies is that those that have got a higher fiscal capacity than average would receive in relative terms less money than those that have got a lower fiscal capacity. That's what an equalization grant basically does. It tries to bring those that have got lower revenue raising capacity to some sort of an average that one chooses and says, basically, this is what we would expect everyone to be able to provide. And so we bring those that are below that are not capable through our grant mechanism. Now, locating it within our current situation, what we have currently is not an equalization grant in terms of the provincial equitable share. What we have is a grant that basically is a block transfer, and the reason is primarily that we have not assigned any meaningful revenue sources to provinces. So provinces depend about 96% of provincial expenditure is met through transfers, either the equitable share or the conditional grant. So that basically means that if you have to move towards an equalization grant, you will have to assign relatively more revenue raising powers to provinces than you currently have. Otherwise, it is just meaningless, because right now what you need to do is to calculate what the expenditure need is and see whether or not you are able to match that with the transfer. That's
right. Maybe the issue of disabilities, and equalization. If you could highlight that.
Okay. Right. Now, when we talk about fiscal disabilities, we refer. For example, if I look at the Northern Cape as a province, it's a very large province, very expansive. It's the largest province in South Africa. It has got the lowest population. In terms of economic activity, it is also not a very highly economically active province. Now, when we talk about fiscal physical disabilities and we look at the Northern Cape, compared to, for example, to Gauteng, which is a small province, very densely populated, very high levels of economic activity, the cost of delivering public services in the Northern Cape versus in Gauteng will be impacted upon by accessibility to the people that you want to receive those services. Now, so you have to accept that from the beginning, the Northern Cape is at a disadvantage because you must deliver, let's say, the same level of service, what you'd expect in terms of the constitution and everybody being equal and all of that. If you really follow that strictly, you should get the same level of service in Gauteng that you must get also in the Northern Cape. Now, in order to do that, per individual, the Northern Cape must actually spend far much more money than Gauteng would spend. Now, if I just treat them as if they're equal and give them the same amount of money per person that they must actually serve, then you're putting the Northern Cape at a very serious disadvantage. So that's a disability that they have. Sometimes fiscal disabilities are a result of just the kind of topography that you have. So you find provinces like your KZN, Eastern Cape, there's lots of mountains and hills, and so to build roads and bridges and all of that, it basically costs far much more than in provinces that don't have that kind of topography. So in designing intergovernmental transfer formulae, those are a range of things that people must take into account. Sometimes even burden of disease makes quite a difference in terms of how much money you actually spend per capita to deliver your services. So you find that there are areas where you've got asbestosis or TB related to asbestos because you had these kinds of mines and all of those kinds of things. The impact on the health of the population there, and you probably need to spend more than somebody else in another province. So it's a whole range of things that would result in cost differentials across, and those are what we refer to as cost disabilities. The extent to which you can account for those in a formula obviously is limited in principle by the need to keep the formula as transparent as possible. So so that if I come here and present a formula here, You must be able to understand what has actually gone into this. So the more of those things I try to put in there, the less accessible it becomes to you, the less transparent it becomes, and you end up with maybe three or five people that actually understand how the formula works. And it's an experience that is real. If you go to a country like Canada, for example, and ask them about their revenue sharing formula, you will find that there's probably only three people the whole country that actually understand how that formula works. Similarly, if you go to Australia, because they include quite a lot of things that they put in there that limit accessibility to scrutiny, basically. How do people scrutinize it if it's that complicated? So if somebody resigns, takes their briefcase away, you need to find somebody else that you're trying to do that. So that's what happens.
No, that's great. So the bottom line really is that we are trying to say the equalization grant, because there are provinces actually that say the formula disadvantages them. So we, with the equalization grant, we are trying to answer their problem. You know, that's really the intention. But otherwise, the explanation is quite perfect and so on. Right. Yeah. Thanks. Now, maybe I should say to the members that Tanya, any other clarifications, Chair, if you can allow, after she explains, if she has not touched it all, we should zero in on her now, because she's about to run.
Yeah. Honourable members, I want to say that I totally empathise with your position. All of us and the research secretariat for the FFC, which is a lot of people, have been thinking about these issues for 18 months. What you say is the product of 18 months research. So it's just not human to be able to absorb all of that information in such a short time. But you see from Dongani, there's a lot of technical issues as well. And what we want to do is just kind of show you what we're thinking, and then the chair wants to arrange subsequent engagements with us, we are here, we can organize something. But I must say, anything to do with the budget is the most difficult thing in government. Because when you look at the budget, you're looking at every single activity of government in one place. You're looking at the entire delivery structure of government across all sectors in government, and that is one big elephant. You can speak...
You know, having said that, this is a committee that must understand how that is done. It is this committee. It is this committee. Yes.
Okay, so I want to write on the specific questions relating to social grants. And I thought Honorable Maki asked the question saying, I said that there's a temptation in countries to substitute grants for fixing delivery problems. I want to give you an example of that. Let's say, for instance, the problem is youth unemployment. The underlying issue is that our vocational training structure is not there to provide the skills development that will match what the economy needs with where our youth are moving through the education system. So we have a temptation to introduce a youth grant. That's a short-term fix, but it does not solve the underlying problem of the dysfunction in our education system, the fact that the tertiary education system can't accommodate all our learners, and that we need to have vocational training that is very practical and will feed the needs of the economy. So there's always a temptation to say, okay, we've now put the bandage on, we've solved the problem. Right? Another way where grants also can be used to circumvent delivery structures is, let's say that your clinics are so bad that nobody wants to go to it. Right? So we have access in the clinics, but people will rather pay big dollar steel to go to a private sector doctor rather than go to a clinic. Right? It's not because they feel that, yes, they'll have to sit in these queues, you know, they'll rather beg from their neighbor or borrow or whatever. And what some countries have done is said, look, instead of paying the money to the department and the department's not spending the money, can we give the money directly to the people in form of a voucher? It says, $200 voucher, you can take it to any private sector clinic or doctor and they will treat you, you pay them the $200 voucher. The problem there is that you will have immediate delivery, but what are you doing? Are you building your public sector delivery structures? You know, you won't. So what I'm saying is that you have to be very careful about how you use grants and realize that grants can be a bandage, but they seldom address the underlying issues that we need to address. So it's not that we don't have grants, but we need to say what are the underlying issues as well. Okay, then moving on to the link between social grants and employment. The question, if I understood it, was, is this related to the expanded public works program? And the answer is yes, right? But we do have some reservations about that, okay? One is that the expanded public works program hasn't shown much capacity in the past. Now we're asking it to do an even more difficult job. How are they going to gear up to be able to do that? So there's a set of questions around, it's a good idea in principle, but to make it a reality, how are they going to get that capacity? The other important issue is, you know, when the Social Security Agency was created, SASA, there was a split in social development departments. Social grants were taken to SASA, right, okay, but social assistance, like counseling to families, basically the work that will get dependent people out of the grant system remain with the provincial departments. Okay, and we call that social assistance, right? And there was always supposed to be a link between social security and social assistance. So that, you know, yes, you got out of the grant, but then you'd be helped to how to get out of the grant, right? Okay, so for instance, related to maybe the next question that was asked, the issue about the caregiver as opposed to the biological mother. The grant system will pay the grants, but it's only the social assistance sector that will determine who actually is the caregiver and you know, is the funding reaching the kid that it's supposed to reach. So those two were actually split. Now, the thing is, once you move towards this welfare, you're saying we must bring social security and social assistance to actually work together. So it's not just SASA sitting and paying grants, but it's also related to how do you skill people up so that they can enter the economy again. And there are people who cannot get jobs because they have no experience. they get out and they get experience, right? So I would tell you that Catch-22 situation requires close coordination between the Special Security Agency and the nine provincial departments. And so while we thought it's a very good idea, the question is, how do you make this happen in practice? Okay, then moving on to one last question. I think the question was on, yes, we know that our social grant system has been good to date. It has been well targeted, and the benefits have outweighed the cost. But if we expand it, will this hold true? Right? Now, there's something in economics, you know, when I was still teaching Economics 1 at UCT, there's something called the Laffer Curve, and it was basically about taxation. And it says, you know, as you increase taxation, you get more money as an intake. But you reach a certain point where people get hurtful. Then they stop paying tax. So as you increase your tax rates, your tax yields actually start decreasing. Does that make sense? So there's a point where you can get enough of a good thing, too much of a good thing. The question is, where is that point? And so a lot of people are debating, okay, are we at the Laffer Curve point where the benefits will be less than the costs? Okay, but what the FFC is arguing is that at this stage, there doesn't seem to be empirical evidence that the costs outweigh the benefits. But we need to keep an eye on what those costs are, so that we make sure that we don't reach that stage where it actually becomes counterproductive. And very importantly, we need to look at the underlying problems that the social development sector is trying to solve. So coming back to education, we hope to give these people the child grant. We hope that these kids will stay in school. We hope that they will learn. We hope that they will go out and be productive citizens who can actually fulfill all their mental, physical, spiritual potential. But we know that that's not happening. We've expanded access, but we haven't expanded quality. And if you look at South Africa, at the 297 countries on some of these tests, we were lost. Northern Beck and Zimbabwe scored better than us. So the question is, it's very easy to say, look, expand the child grant. But what are we doing about the quality of schooling that will ensure that once these kids reach the edge of the grant, you know, that they can go on and more productive lives in society? So those are the type of hard questions we actually need to answer, because when we put the grants in place, we assumed that the education was coming online, that the centers were going to work, all of those things. Now we have the grants working, but everything else that is going to lift people up is basically not working. And so we need to look at those things. I think that basically covered my question, right, Chair, so I'll hand back to colleagues to deal with the other questions.
Right. Chair, as I indicated, she's about to run. I wonder whether the honourable members are satisfied.
No, I've got quarter of an hour.
Oh, I see. Okay. No, thanks very much. Okay, let me try and answer in probably the order that I slightly rearranged it from the order that it was asked, but the first question I got about the trade-offs on page 24, trade-offs in the design of tariffs. The trade-off is essentially between the need to raise revenues, okay, so to get more revenue to pay for infrastructure investment, to pay for more maintenance of water infrastructure and so forth, and keeping the price of water affordable to households at the end of the day. That's the key trade-off that needs to be made. So, many households are now in shock and dismay that there's a 31% increase in electricity tariffs from Eskom. There's a very difficult trade-off that needed to be made there by the regulator, and the National Energy Regulator in this case, between the significant funding that was needed from the prices we pay as consumers to build new gas stations and the need to keep it affordable to consumers. So they made the trade-off in a particular way. In water services, there's evidence that municipalities have been historically reducing the price, keeping the price of water quite low. Okay, so they're recovering, just like what was happening in the electricity sector. They were keeping electricity prices low and sacrificing spending that they should have been doing on
rates of inflation and so forth. We haven't, as a commission, done a full study on that yet, but we've highlighted it as an issue that we need to look at more closely so that we don't get ourselves into the same position that we had with the electricity emergency, although that would obviously play out very differently. And there's another point on that that I will come back to. But that is the basic trade-off, how much you charge relative to what is affordable. The question on the hook down on the access to for communities to water when they need a large water resource kind of bulk infrastructure like that dam, I'm not sure exactly what they should there is, and I haven't looked at it directly. There might be water allocation issues in the sense that a dam was built specifically to provide the mining industry with water, and the water is of a particular quality.
I think the question, the WOP was just made as an example. The question is just, it is a general trend across the country. There are dams where poor communities live, but water is transported elsewhere. I think that was the gist of the question.
Yeah, I don't think that's been, from the commission side, we haven't looked at that as an issue. I think that is something that we probably need to consider. There are, both inter-basin transfer schemes, very large-scale inter-river transfer schemes. The Sutu Highlands Water Project is an example of that, which feeds water, which provides the bulk of water to Gauteng. And then there are other smaller scale ones, whether they're dams on the Rock Coast area that supplies an industry or a mine or a large urban area, but not the communities on the way. But that may be for historical reasons, in the sense that when the infrastructure was built, they weren't considered to be part of the service area, so they were just ignored. In many instances, I know the Department of Water Affairs had tried to intervene to change that situation and give those communities access to water. The typical constraints are either on allocation issues, in that the water has been guaranteed to a mine for a particular purpose, and there's no further water that's available, and because in terms of the existing water rights for that area, or water quality issues, because one must remember that dam water is not necessarily safe for human consumption. It can be contaminated either chemically or biologically, and therefore would require treatment, and that treatment infrastructure may not exist. But it's not an area we've studied. But those, I would imagine, would be the two issues that would make it a difficult issue to resolve, other than just putting a pipe in and allowing those communities to extract water from the source, of either allocation or quality issues. On the water harvesting issue, I think that, yes, there are a lot of possibilities for partnerships with innovators, whether those innovators are NGOs or communities themselves using historical or traditional water management practices. But I think that what the Commission is saying in terms of partnerships is to say let's actively pursue those partnerships. What we've seen since 2000 is a retreat from partnerships, rather than the expansion and really building on the capacities of NGOs and communities. As municipalities have moved more actively into water supply as a function, they tend to see it as an in-house function that is only, which is their role. And they've been rather adverse to participation by community-based structures, by non-government organizations, by the private sector. Whereas in actual fact, all three of those parties bring enormous capacities and ideas, including water harvesting, where that's an appropriate technology to use. So we need to kind of look at ways that can be reversed, and municipalities encourage not to see themselves as a water provider, but rather as the enabler of provision, whether it be through water harvesting, small-scale community-managed networks, or large management contracts or leases in areas, depending on what is appropriate for a particular area. The graphs, I'm sorry I didn't go through the graphs. I didn't realize they would provoke so much interest, and I guess I've seen the graphs too many times before, so I'm not graphy. let me just go on for right now, I think it's a very important thing to reflect back on, because if one's going to set targets that at the time when people looked at those targets, it's going to be very difficult for South Africa to meet those targets. I mean, the 2014 is a much more reasonable target. There's no mechanisms to hold the development to account. It's just been allowed to shift the target, which debases the notion of a time-based target as well. And that is disturbing. If it can just simply renegotiate the target every time it feels it's not going to meet it. There are a range of issues, but I think that the new ministries, or the new ministers of power and monitoring and evaluation are grappling with as well. What is an appropriate indicator, how do we measure the indicator, and so on and so forth. And I think the Department of Water Affairs is perhaps the most overexcited and made the biggest mistake in this respect, because this probably is an inappropriate target. Both the data they use to manage it, to measure that progress, is not independently verifiable and confuses expenditure with actual number of households connected, and those are two very different things, as you would know, and so forth. In terms of the MDGs, I think remember the MDGs in water and sanitation are to halve the number of people without access in both of these indicators. I think that in the case of drinking water, we are on track. Or I think we have met it. Already, I'm not 100% sure on exactly where we stand there. The key issue, I think, for South Africa is not just the availability, but the safety of the water, and making sure that communities have access to safe, protected water sources. Sanitation, I think the situation has been a lot less desirable. I think we haven't managed to really meet, I'm not sure if we're going to manage to meet the sanitation backlog. I think the Department of Water Affairs will say that we will. I don't think we have to date, and we would need to, and that's an area that that requires further evaluation. We didn't specifically look at our progress relative to the MDGs in our research work. But that's certainly something we could do some research on, and by the next time we meet, we could probably structure a discussion around that, because I think it is a useful indicator. When it comes to the graphs themselves, what they're showing is the level of access to piped water, which is not the MDG standard. Remember, the MDG standard is safe water, which may be through a hand pump, borehole access, or whatever. It's showing it for the first column, for the provinces, with the country as a whole on the right. It's showing it for each province. In the first bar is for the census 2001 data, and the second bar is community survey 2007 data. Easy to have a mind. I look on the screen, I see that it hasn't come out so clearly on the screen, so you can't really make sense of the table, which at the bottom, which is really what makes the whole thing come together. What can see that what one would predict is there has been an increase in levels of access to pipe water across all provinces, but the levels of access remain quite low in our poorest provinces, the Eastern Cape, KZN, and Limpopo. I think one needs to be cautious about ever assuming one will ever have 100% access to piped water, because that discounts any other source of access to water when a rural community is using a borehole, whether it could be a mechanized borehole and a very appropriate source of water. A farmer might not have access to piped water. Might always use borehole water, and it may not be appropriate. So one doesn't always reach 100% access. But some provinces, as you can see, Free State, Gauteng, Western Cape, have come very close to achieving 100% access. And in fact, their challenge is not to expand access to water, but it's probably to focus more on water quality issues going forward. And that's where the MDG is a very well-designed indicator, because It's not just the availability of water, it's the quality of it as well. When it comes to sanitation, it's a very similar graph, but showing, I think, a less encouraging picture in terms of access to fresh toilets, which would be septic tank related or network waterborne networks, not ventilated improved pit latrines, which are regarded as a safe sanitation source that meet our standards. There's still large gaps in the Free State in particular, where a large number of households use bucket sanitation, which is an unacceptable source unacceptable standard of service, and there are efforts to eradicate that. Part of the problem, as I understand it, in the Free State is that there's been a preponderance of efforts to put in networked waterborne sewage systems, which are extremely expensive and not always affordable in the areas that they're being installed, instead of looking at other technologies, whether that be septic tanks, community toilet blocks, or ventilated improved pit latrines. You also notice the decline in the level of access in the Northern Cape, which may well be just backsliding against indicators, is not uncommon when there's lack of maintenance of networks, lack of investment in the integrity of sewage networks. Is that enough explanation on the graph, or would people like me to spend more time on that? Okay. I think we, as the chairperson mentioned, we'd be very happy to sit down and go through more data on the water sector, and in fact for all areas of our research, we're at your disposal in that respect.
Yeah, I'm just interested in Limpopo there, because I'm from Limpopo. Does it mean they use the bush?
That's what's very politely called open defecation. Where people are forced to go to the bush on an unacceptable level of sanitation. So in some case, what the graph is looking at is fresh toilets. But there will be a large number of people who have access to know whether it's acceptable or not, no level of service when it comes to sanitation, and then they're not the bush, and that is very inappropriate. It erodes human dignity, it creates a public health hazard, it's a safety hazard for women, for example, this is where, it's not that open defecation is uncommon, but not in South Africa. Little though we may talk about it, or in many other developing countries right across the world, it's very common with people that have nowhere to go. You've got to go, and then they're forced to go behind the bush or whatever. And so it's a very important public policy challenge to allow people to give people the right to have access to a basic sanitation service. Remember that it's not the infrastructure that's the critical thing. The outcomes that we're looking for are health and dignity outcomes. So let's not get obsessed about thinking we must provide a flush toilet everywhere across the country. That's who we want. We want to protect people's dignity. We want to protect their health.
If I may just interrupt to the... I think that Comrade, is clear that as we were discussing the other day, we really need to collaborate with other committees, because if you look at this, and 56.3% of households in Limpopo use a pit latrine, and obviously Mr. Savage is right to say we have a water scarcity problem in the country, but I think that other committees must be able to go deep into understanding as to, is that the only, is it because there's no possibility of a greater number of households having access to these facilities? But I think that is not a debate for now. It's something that I mean, that's why it's important to engage with other committees when we invite FSC next time, so that as portfolio committees that are directly responsible can have the same understanding that we have of these matters. Thank you.
Okay. So there's certainly a lot to talk about when one looks at those figures in it, and the figures in Limpopo are worrying. So we're actually very, very happy to keep talking about it and start to unpack some of the reasons why that may be the case. The other questions were around what are the shortcomings that are implicit in the current subsidy system. Elsewhere. Secondly, indigenous Certain policies do not work when you don't have access to services. You can't provide a sanitation subsidy to 80% of households in Limpopo or whatever the amount is that don't have access to services, because that figure is just for flush toilets. So the priority is to remain getting your authorizing access to the service in the first place before the emergence policy can have any effect whatsoever. I think the question is the other point about indigenous policies is the relative benefit of the approaches that you're looking at. So I mean that's what we're going to study going forward as the FSC is how are we managing these various trade-offs in making sure that support to poor households through municipalities is extracts the best value for money, is most effective. Because we sometimes, I think, overemphasize providing full basic services, when what we need to do is emphasize just providing access to services. You know, why are we chasing up after a municipality with very low levels of access and saying, well, it's your full basic service policy? Because those are access to the service are the lucky ones at this point. We need to expand access dramatically. Anyway, I think those points are made. The question on one of the principles and practices around tariffs and subsidy, this was essentially saying we need to encourage municipalities and tariff setting agencies to reflect back on a considerable economic literature on the subject of the importance of transparent, and when it comes to tariffs, of very transparent tariff setting processes, so people understand what they're paying for. I was on the Nelson Mandela website, Nelson Mandela Bay website yesterday. In fact, I was looking for the refuse tariffs, and the only information I could find, and I spent a while there, was the average annual increases in tariffs. But as a resident of Nelson Mandela Bay, I'm not a resident there, but they're actually paying. They don't know how much it's increasing. You know, so transparency is critical. In setting tariffs, they do have to be cost reflective, so that they apportion costs to those who get the benefits, and they have to be fair in the way that they do that. Subsidies again, the principles of transparency and fairness, and some of the practices of, in fact, principles even of in the case of the equitable sharing, in terms of administrative ease of implementing it, you can develop very complicated tariff systems that are administratively too complex to manage, and as a result fail. But different municipalities come to different arrangements on how they're going to set their tariffs. For example, Ekurhuleni, until this year, charged for refuse as part of its property rates, whereas Pretoria charges Tshwane Metro charges for refuse from this year on the basis of the volume produced. Those are two very different tariff structures. So they have to measure the volume of your waste per meter of waste in China, and in Ethiopia, so recently, they didn't do anything. So the tariff structures have very different incentive effects on households. In Ethiopia, you have no incentive to reduce your waste. You can chuck away as much as you like. Okay, whereas in China, you have a very strong incentive to compact and reduce and minimize and so forth, because you pay more for the more waste that you put out. The question of water shortage in South Africa, I think that the consensus is that while South Africa is a dry country in global terms, it's a water scarce country, we don't face a water shortage in terms of the quantity of water. What we do face is a risk on the quality of our water. So with declining quality comes reduced access, because that water suddenly no longer safe, or it's no longer industry or business can no longer use it because it's of too low quality, chemically or biologically. You can't use it for in the food industry or something like that. I think with this question of the scarcity of water is really the quality issue. and in some cases the service provider, although in a reducing number of cases. So there's a conflict of interest there. I think that's the point that we've been making. Clarifies that if you're a service provider, you're not going to regulate yourself, although the department is getting out of that that part of the sector. But a policymaker says, listen, you know, we want all our water to be safe, or 80% of our water to be safe, and they start to support agencies to do that and so on and so forth, is going to have a very different take on measuring success than a regulator who has got a pure enforcement role, a pure compliance role. You asked around who regulates water quality now in terms of municipalities, Department of Water Affairs, CSIR, and so forth. At the moment, it is a function of the Department of Water Affairs, and let's be honest, they've made, I think, some very important progresses now. They now give municipalities blue drop and green drop status for water and wastewater, respectively, and those are available on their website. So they're starting to play a much more active regulatory role. But this is just on the monitoring side. Whether it will actually turn into enforcement, I think, is an issue that we would certainly have some doubts about, whether it will turn into rigorous enforcement of municipalities that fall below required standards. The CSIR is a technical support agency, so while it does provide measurement services, water testing services and so forth to municipalities on request, it doesn't have a regulatory role around water quality. A lot of municipalities use the services of larger adjacent municipalities. Etiquette Water Services, for example, provides water testing services to adjacent municipalities in the area because it has its own laboratory. But others can use the CSIR, and others don't do it at all, which is very problematic. One does need to, of course, test water quality for both chemical and biological contamination regularly. And not just at the treatment end, but at the consumer end, when it comes out of the tap. I think that was... Oh, sorry, there were more questions. How do we get rid of consultants? I would ask the question, I grant you that there's a lot of evidence of very poor management of consultants. And I would go so far as to say of advisors as well, where they come in, whether it be for a short or a long term period, and just simply do the work of people who are already employed to do work. I don't think we necessarily want to get rid of consultants. We want to make sure that in local government, we want to make sure that they are properly contracted. So there are certain skills that it doesn't make sense for a municipality to keep in-house. For a lot of municipalities, it may not make sense to have a full-time engineer. It may make sense to share an engineer across two or three municipalities so they spend more than $2,000 a week there. They would not be full-time staff. They would be contractors to the municipality. We want to keep those going and encourage those kind of relationships, but not the relationships where they're doing jobs of someone who's employed already, because there's very little quality control on their outputs. Those are two very unacceptable outcomes, which I think we do see, and I think is where your concern emanates from. I'm not sure what we do, but I don't think the answer is to get rid of consultants altogether. I think we need to look at improved supply chain management practices so that there's better specification of the tasks and there's better exit monitoring in terms of the quality of the work that was performed. The question of shouldn't revenue always be a focus? I was using revenue as just as an example. There are a number of areas where capacity building programs do offer support to municipalities. The revenue, I think, is an important focus for all of the reasons. The issue that we were raising, and I was using it as an example, is not that revenue isn't an important issue, but does it make sense to have seven different programs simultaneously offering support on the revenue function? That speaks to duplication, overlap, and confusion. And everyone piling in because they guessed revenue was an important issue. Yes, it is. But you're not going to sort it out by having seven cross-cutting programs sailing across each other's bows. You've probably probably likely to mess it up even more by getting contradictory advice, lack of strategy, lack of sequencing, everything happening simultaneously. So I think that our concern was just how strategic the support was, rather than whether the issue was a strategic issue. It absolutely is a strategic issue. I think that was it from my side.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, sir. I'll start with the performance of public hospitals. The chair asked the question around the standardization of budgets at the hospital level. Yes, we have made that recommendation, and the reason being that now we can compare provincial health budgets, you know, at the provincial level. You know, we know that they have about 8 programs, so it's easy to benchmark how much provinces are spending on public health care. But it's difficult to make that analysis at the hospital level, you know. And the reason being that there are no norms and standards, you know, to allocate per hospital. So each and every province, they use their own methodologies or discretion to budget per hospital. Treasury has tried to gazette budgets at that level. But for now, we can't make sense because quite a number of variations. And that's why we are making a recommendation that if you want to make that kind of an analysis based on the type of a hospital, being a central or district hospital, and also based on the number of beds that are there, the utilization, the issues of outpatients, or patients equivalent, we need to make to get that kind of information standardized at the hospital level, and that is why we are making that recommendation. There were quite a number of rental housing questions that were raised. I must say that as the FFC, we have housing as a program, a research program. And for this purpose, we have focused or zoomed in on rental housing. So other aspects related to housing are not covered for now, but this is on rental housing. And now the questions raised around the slow disbursements of funds is that for rental housing, we have these housing institutes or institutions that are providing the service or constructing rental housing. So they put their money and also depend on the restructuring grant or whatever. They benefit from that grant. But then the transfer mechanism is that the Department of Housing will transfer the money to the province and then the province to the institution. So it's difficult to align plans and budgets. You know, they put the application and then the province will have to negotiate with your National Department of Human Settlement now. And we are saying that process need to be reviewed, you know, because it hampers the construction or the delivery of rental housing. Around restructuring zones basically are designated areas for these rental housing, or social housing, because we must not confuse the two. Social housing, basically, it's, you know, your former hostels that are now being transformed into family units. Those are categorized now as social housing. But then there are these rental housings which are also delivered by social housing institutions. And they must work with your provinces and certain cases, municipalities, to zone, you know, the area. So we are saying they must be expanded, and you know, social houses must work with government to identify those areas. Income bands the same theory with subsidies, because you find that other people, their salaries are, you know, when your salary is revised, it can be in line with the with the inflation or below the inflation. That is why you have people embarking on strikes and so forth, saying that they want the inflation related or above the cost of living. And we are saying this is having an impact, because not all subsidies are in line with the adjustments to inflation. And the Commission is making a recommendation that at least we must try to link the subsidies in line with the cost of living adjustment. Around roads, there was a question raised on the role of DFIs, Development Finance Institutions. I mean, broadly, the Commission is saying that we must look at the way we finance provincial and local government roads. Now, we need to relate this to the funding instruments for national roads. We have SANRAL, which is funded through the national fiscus. It can toll certain national roads to raise revenue. It can go to the market and borrow. You know, they issue bonds. You know. Now, relate that to how your provincial and local government roads are funded. Basically, provincial is through the national transfer, you know, and local government,
I think that the question of DFA, and she tried to explain that the Development Facilitation Act, which is related to issues of housing, how it impacts on the water.
Okay, I'll come to it. There was another one that was raised, your development and finance institutions. Yes. So this one you are saying that, you know, I know that in certain municipalities, they can go INCA, which is a developmental finance institution, and your DPSA and whatever. They are playing a role in terms of financing certain municipalities to like borrowing municipalities for infrastructure development. And we are saying that we need to look at that mechanism. And this is related to our chapter also on infrastructure, on public infrastructure. We are saying, you know, and PES, your equitable share, there's a recommendation that, you know, these spheres of government should also be allowed to borrow for infrastructure development. And here we are being specific that development finance institutions like your INCA, your development bank, can assist your local authorities to expand their road infrastructure in cases where the fiscus cannot cover the investment requirements. Around the DFA, sorry, I missed it because it's a housing issue. That's one area that we didn't cover in this round of rental housing. But it does serve as an act that was passed in 1995, I think Act number 67, which and calls for your development tribunals and so forth, and see that land is used adequately, not for your recreational services, because your golf courses, but you must make sure that, you know, it's for agriculture, human settlement, and so forth. But it's not an area that we have covered in detail in under rental housing. So as a program, I think then moving forward, we'll have look at the role of Development Facilitation Act in terms of land usage. Lastly, the issue of housing and whether human settlements, now that we are moving into human settlements, will play a role. It's an encouraging, but you must remember that constitutionally housing is it's a concurrent function between national government and provincial government in terms of Schedule 4A. And if you look at human settlements broadly, we are talking about water, we are talking about electricity, we are talking about your roads, are amenities that are important for housing development, and those are municipal functions, your electricity distribution, water distribution. So how do you link that from an IGFR or IGR perspective? So it's at the national level, we have Department of Human Settlement. We have seen certain provinces have replicated the structure. But what does that mean from, you know, housing delivery, making sure that you don't have houses that still do not have roads, electricity, and certain cases would, because, you know, there must be coordination and interlinkages between housing delivery and other amenities. So that's an area that the FFC, we are hoping that we'll be making a submission in the next round. Yeah.
Thank you.
There was one other question that was asked of you, Dr. Sitai, related to the challenges that we've identified. You specifically mentioned five, and then you left out.
Yes, no, you can come out. That's fine.
Okay, no, that one. I think the two that Dr. Stein did not speak to. Basically, the one is around the proliferation of conditional grants, and that is linked to the funding of concurrent functions. And the other one is the stalling of implementation of government policies. That relates to, for example, the impact of stalling. Once government decides to do something and then you don't implement, for example, your issue around the roads, your issue around the accreditation of municipalities and housing, you have certain impacts that basically have to do with incentives that are generated within the system. If one even thinks about the financing of primary health care and what the impact of that actually is on municipalities, like those big municipalities that still provide primary health care on behalf of provinces, and they are beginning to speak about unfunded mandates and all of those. Those are the two key areas that we're also looking at.
Thank you, Chair. Oh, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much,
Dr. Stai and the colleagues from FFC. We think that your presentation was really exhaustive, and I think that it has generated a lot of interest from members. But we will come back to you in terms of if there are further clarity that we need or further engagement that we need. Obviously, the next process now would be to engage with the relevant department. But we will obviously consult with you, as we indicated earlier, that the majority of members are not here. And now, in the past, FFC was seen as an area that was important for the NCOP, but now with the legislation that we're having, that we have begun to implement, it is a requirement of that legislation that there should be engagement between ourselves and yourselves. And maybe as we move on, I think that there might be some clarity that yourselves and us might want to engage in terms of, I mean, with respect to the legislation, and maybe also with respect to our colleagues at the NSOP, to say exactly
what would be meant by this engagement for those areas that were primarily covered by NCOP, for instance. But maybe that will be also an internal matter. Colleagues, I think that we have come to the end of our agenda, and I would like to take this opportunity to thank you for sacrificing to go home early and be here. Otherwise, thank you very much, and this meeting stands adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.